You are listening to The Kevin Smith Show.
Comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people who make them and do not necessarily represent the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or any of its affiliates or advertisers. And good evening, ladies and gentlemen, whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this beautiful place we call Earth. Thanks for being here at the Kevin Smith Show. Those of you joining us for the very first time, welcome aboard. We're glad to have you. And hope you make a habit out of it. It's a great habit to get into. Be sure, if this is your first time, be sure that you take just the few seconds that is required to subscribe to our free weekly newsletter. The free weekly newsletter is called the K-Files e-zine. So if you look at the player, if you're using our player on our website, you'll see a link that says K-Files, and it may or may not be working. We're transitioning, as you know, moving our website from the old host, which was iPower, to the new host, which is Bluehost. And so parts of it, anyway, the main stuff is working, and we're working to get it all fixed up. Seems like we do this every so often, doesn't it? But the fact is, for 4 years, we were at iPower and kept having to recode things, and enough's enough. So if I'm going to recode it, I'll recode it for a new host, and one where I can just assume things will stay level. Anyway, if that doesn't work for you, then go over to kevinsmithshow.com, and you'll see where it says K-Files e-zine. You'll see it in red letters. I talked with someone today that was a tech support person and described a problem I was having, and it was not at our new host. And I said, open up my website. It's easier for you to see it than it is for me to explain it. So open up my website. She did. And I said, okay, now click over there where it says member login. And she said, where? I said, on the menu. And she said, where's your menu? I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe it. Hey, did you hear about this thing in Houston? It's pretty big news. There was a Continental Airlines pilot that reported that something flew past his cockpit and it looked like a rocket, and it had a trail behind it. He said he thought it was a rocket. The FBI is investigating it, and they think that it's probably a model rocket that somebody set off. That's legal to build and fly model rockets, but according to reports, if you're anywhere near controlled airspace, you're supposed to let the FAA know what you're doing and where you're doing it. And certainly no rockets are supposed to be flying past commercial airliners as they're taking off or as they're doing anything else. But it did. And so now the FBI is investigating it, and they say that thought this was the case. They said that FBI investigates anything that has to do with any kind of danger to commercial airplanes, and so they're looking into it. As it stands right now, it appears this is going to be listed as a model rocket, the kind that hobbyists build, and not a bottle rocket, not one of those 4th of July things. This, you know, it's a real rocket, but it's built by hobbyists. All right, my guest this evening is Tom Horn. He's been with us before. He's with us again, and it's always a mind bender when he's with us. Don't go away. Most of the great music you hear right here on Steel Eye Media Network is supplied by the independent artists from GarageBand.com. If you hear a song you like, go over to GarageBand.com, look it up, download it. You can even buy the group's CDs, in many cases, right there at GarageBand.com. Alien Seeker News has blasted off and is providing a new and important resource for everyone interested in UFOs, aliens, alien abductions, Bigfoot, Chupacabra, and more. Featuring five of the top UFO radio talk shows, lots of information and articles and free forums, Alien Seeker News has launched on its journey to greatness. Go to AlienSeekerNews.com, register for the free forums, and get the classic Flying Saucers Are Real by Major Donald Kehoe as a free ebook. Join today. Most of the great music you hear right here on Steel Eye Media Network is supplied by the independent artists from GarageBand.com. If you hear a song you like, go over to GarageBand.com, look it up, download it. You can even buy the group's CDs, in many cases, right there at GarageBand.com. Did you know the Kevin Smith Show selects one of its very best shows each week and turns it into a free podcast? Well, it's true. You can download free Kevin Smith Show podcast right now and get a free fresh podcast each week. Do you want to start building your own library of Kevin Smith shows? All you have to do is visit our website at kevinsmithshow.com and click the free podcast link. They're yours for the download. My guest is Tom Horn. Tom has been with us before. But you know what? Each and every time Tom is with us, it's always something new and different, exciting. He expands our minds. He's a well-known radio personality, CEO of Raiders News Network, and he is a published author. He's got several books out. He's also referred to in articles that have appeared in the LA Times, on MSNBC, Christianity Today, World Net Daily, White House correspondents, and dozens of news magazines and press agencies around the globe. His latest book is called the, I always pronounce it wrong, Ahriman Gate, which is fiction but deals with some pretty real technology. Tom, welcome back to the show.
Well, Kevin, thank you for having me back on. And just one fast correction. The Ahriman Gate actually is the second to my latest book. My newest book is actually called Nephilim Stargates, The Year 2012 and the Return of the Watchers. And it's been my best-selling book ever. It's actually set sales records for the publisher, and I couldn't be happier about it.
You know, I knew that. I've got it right in front of me, and I just didn't look at my notes. So I apologize for that. But that is, in fact, what I want us to get into tonight. But now, lots of our folks have not heard you before. They don't know you. So why don't you just sort of tell us a little bit about who you are?
Okay, Kevin. Well, of course, you know, my wife and I have been involved in a lot of things over the years, from actually pastoring for nearly 25 years, in which time I also served as an exorcist for the institution and also held state and executive titles for the largest evangelical institution in the world. But what makes me different, I think, is that my family has a unique background. I also have an interest in talking about a phenomenon which doesn't always fit in very well with your mainline institutional thinking. And as a result, you know, some years ago, I decided it would be better for me to set aside my credentials and to start the news agency, RaidersNewsNetwork.com, with my wife, which has continued to grow and now is visited by just literally millions and millions of people. And that's what we've been doing over the last 15 years or so. And really, I'm happy to say that the last few years, we've actually had more time for writing and talking about things that interest us. And, of course, my last two books illustrate that among those interests are things like ancient history, especially as it relates to such things like the mythology of the gods who came down and commingled with humans and created this unusual offspring. That's a story, you know, that's told in Greek mythology and Egyptian mythology and Hebrew folklore. This story, it's actually repeated around the world, and that's partly what my last two books are about, but certainly not entirely what they're about. But my interest in these, Kevin, is that, you know, we call them mythology, but in my mind, the older I get, the more I believe that these widespread stories really are, at least to some extent, a record of fact. In other words, a record from around the world, from different cultures who, in their own way, recorded something that had occurred where superintelligence came to the earth, blended its species with humanity, and that there was this unusual offspring. And of course, ultimately, in some of those records, it led to chaos. But things like that. I'm interested in talking about UFOs, alien abduction, the Watchers, the Nephilim, the Giants, you know, cryptozoology, cryptoarchaeology. Those are the things that I just have a kick talking about and researching.
Well, you've got some family connection to part of that. Your sister and your niece, I believe, have had experiences that some people would call alien abduction. What's that all about?
Well, and that's actually one of the reasons, you know, that I spent part of my adult life researching this strange ancient story about the Watchers, because it had to do with the fact that they were harvesting or manipulating human and animal DNA. A fact that reminded me of alien abduction, because if you study what goes on in alien abduction, there is this need to harvest. Jacques Vallée, Dr. John Mack, all recorded, and these are secular researchers and some of the best researchers, recorded how these visitations included the need for some reason to harvest DNA, scoop marks on humans, the collection of ovum. But not just humans. You go to bed one night, you wake up the next day, and Skippy the horse is laying out there in the field, you know, with parts of its body that have been removed with laser-like surgical precision. And so far, Interpol and the NSA and the CIA and every other intelligence agency in the world has not been able to track down the global blood-sucking cult that keeps taking these animals and humans and harvesting this material, what Vallée called vital energy, matter, that is for some reason being collected from three-dimensional intelligent life forms for the purposes of what? Everybody concludes probably for the purposes of creating a body into which they could extend themselves or maybe preserve their unknown species. And this, of course, is exactly what the Watchers were doing. So that was my whole interest in this. And then, of course, I don't know, Kevin, the last time I was on your show, what we talked about. So I don't want to go back and repeat information, but my interest in all of this also had a need on my part to understand something that had been occurring in my family since the time that I was a very young man. And I went on to become a pastor and then earned a doctorate in theology and served in executive levels in the institution. But this entire time, there was skeletons in my family closet that I did not feel comfortable talking about with most of the people that I knew inside the institution, because I knew their cookie cutter answers wouldn't be capable of answering for me some of this phenomenology, and also even just the mathematical statistical improbability. One of these days I'm going to write a book, because all of this started when I was a kid and my dad, who was a police officer, had made this amazing discovery while he was deer hunting in the mountains of Arizona. He came across these large spherical craters, probably 20 feet across and 8 feet deep. I've still got pictures of these if people want to see them. These things were so precise that it looked as if an enormous white-hot ball had just routered down into the rock. And my dad had grown up riding fence lines for the Bard Ranch, the largest open territory cattle ranch in the state of Arizona. He knew the desert like the back of his hands, and then including being a cop, of course, he knew the desert. And he had hunted in this area, and these things seemed to have appeared just overnight. And the finish on the walls of these things was such that, as far as he understood, it didn't appear that any kind of, like drilling technology or something like that had made them, because in Arizona, if you know anything about the desert, the water there will dissipate very quickly, and whatever had made this had not even cracked the shale in the rock so that the water wasn't running out. These things were filled to the top with water. In fact, they were full of deer, and one of the deer was still alive, swimming around trying to survive. Well, anyway, Dad took pictures of these holes, and then it came home, showed them to the family. I have a picture of that as well, by the way. And then he led a representative of the Army Corps of Engineers to that location. And the bottom line, to make this story shorter, is that the origin of those craters was never determined. The Corps of Engineers dynamited the holes full of rock in order to keep the wildlife from falling into them and dying. But it was so mysterious that the Phoenix Gazette went out and took pictures of my dad kneeling down beside these orbs with his 30-06 hunting rifle. And they ran an article called Mysterious Mountain Holes, trying to find somebody who might be able to explain any theory about where these things had come from or how they were made, because even the Corps couldn't figure out how they were made. But nobody ever came forward. That was the end of the story. Then, some years later, on November 5, 1975, along the northeastern ridge of that Arizona mountain range, a man by the name of Travis Walton stepped out of a pickup to look up at what he called a glowing object. And according to his report, he had a crew of loggers that were with him that waited nearby while he walked up to this thing. According to the story, he approached this UFO and was suddenly jolted by a blast of inexplicable energy. His companions took off in terror. Travis was left there alone. Days later, he showed up in town by himself and said that he had been taken on board an alien spacecraft and subjected to a variety of physical examinations. His story became known as Fire in the Sky, and it was made into a motion picture, it was made into a book, and reports to this day what is considered to be one of the best documented accounts of a UFO abduction ever recorded. Now, I don't know if Travis's story is true. I've had mini conversation with Stanton Friedman, and I asked him at one point if he believed Walton's story was true because Walton had actually spent time at his house, and he said that he absolutely did believe that his story was true. So I don't know.
That you bring him up, Stanton, because that's who's going to be my guest tomorrow evening. But, you know, one of the reasons that I believe that it's true is because, or let me say this, one of the reasons I buy the story as being factual is because Travis and the other loggers were all subjected to polygraph,
yeah,
and they all passed.
And many years later, all of them still stick to their story. Their story has never changed. It's never been embellished to become more than it was. It also has not diminished to any admission on any of their parts that, okay, maybe we stretch a story. So the people seem to be credible, and they pass their lie detection tests. So, but my point about this is, I don't know if there was a connection between what my dad had discovered and then in the same area some years later, Travis Walton being abducted in that area, but I do know that along that mountain range, that northeastern ridge of Arizona. By the way, you're in Arizona, right?
That's right. I'm in the Phoenix area.
So, right just across the Agua Fria River from Sun City, I grew up in the small Arizona town of El Mirage. And so you have Sun City, you cross the river there, and then it's El Mirage, and then Surprise, and then now Sun City West has grown plumb over there going towards Luke Air Force Base. It's huge now. And then Whitman and Wickenburg and all that. But that's where I grew up. That's my old stomping grounds out there. And the Bard Ranch where my dad worked was kind of between where Sun City is now and Lake Pleasant, although I believe Sun City's darn near all the way out to Lake Pleasant now, too. But my point about this was, my dad made that discovery, and what most of the people in the town never knew was shortly thereafter, my aunt, who was not a person of faith at all, she was the definition probably of what most people would think of as a heathen, you know. But she lived just down the road from us, and I did not know this until years later. My mother, who's a very devout Christian, told me this story. How my aunt had come down the road and was absolutely ashen white, petrified by something, and when my mother asked her about it, she claimed that this disc-shaped object had been hovering above our home, and it had scared my aunt so much she wanted to get close to my mom, who she thought was close to God and could protect her from whatever this was. However, it was right after that. Years later, I've been able to put this timeline together in conversations with my mom, because most of my life growing up, my family wouldn't talk about any of this stuff. But it was right after Dad made that discovery that my older sister woke up in the middle of the night. She woke all of us up, I should say. I was in my room asleep, and all of a sudden my sister was just screaming. And I jumped out of bed. My brother jumped out of bed. My mom and dad jumped out of bed. We run to her room, and here she is sitting up in bed with a glaze in her eyes that I would now, today, recognize as a person who was in shock. But as a boy, I didn't know what any of it meant. Mom ran over to her and grabbed her and started trying to talk to her and started praying with her. Right away, Dad took me and my brother out of the room. Some years later, I came to understand through talking to my sister. And when I say some years later, I mean only within the last 5 or 6 years has my sister been willing to talk to me about this. This happened 40-some years ago, long before any of the definitions of alien grays or anything like that was out there or books were being published. There was no internet. There was no classic definition of alien grays available to the general public. And my sister tells me the story of how she woke up that night, and there were these three bulbous-headed beings that were standing at the foot of the bed, at the foot of the bed and along one side of the bed, three of them, and they were stair-stepped. One was a little bit larger than the other, and the other was a little bit larger than the other. And they were talking in a language she couldn't understand. Now, when she first woke up, she told me, she said, I don't know if something had been done to me, that I was paralyzed, or if I was simply so afraid that I couldn't scream, because I thought they might do something to me. And she said, but there I was, and I watched them for a second, these little men with these bulbous heads, and they were talking, and they were interested in her legs, and they were talking about her legs and touching her legs. And she said, then in a moment, the biggest of the three looked at me, and it walked very fast over to me, and it put its hand on my head. And the minute it put its hand on her head, that's when she started screaming. And the next thing she knew, we were all running into the room, and wherever those things went, she doesn't know, but they were gone. And now the thing you have to understand, Kevin, and your listeners, we were a very old-fashioned Christian family. I mean, this nothing that I'm telling you now fit our worldview at all, and it was nothing we'd ever heard about. We were so conservative. I mean, my mom whipped me for playing with a deck of cards. We didn't have a television. We didn't watch TV. We didn't read magazines. We were very, very conservative. And then all of a sudden, this is happening in a family that has no concept of it at all. And so many years later, when I grew up, you know, went through Bible college, earned my degrees, became a pastor, was a pastor of some very large churches, which, you know, when I was on the West Coast pastoring, Trinity Broadcasting Network used my church for their West Coast broadcasts. I had my own daily television show. I had my own daily radio show. So, I mean, I was really entrenched in what was going on. But in the back of my mind was this phenomenon that occurred when we were kids, and that my sister had hinted to me on different occasions was something that was continuing. And yet, you know, I was so reluctant for so many years to share any of this, to talk about it, because of the resistance that you can find among the in-the-box theological interpretations among so many people of faith. And yet, What got me, Kevin, was I started thinking about the mathematical improbabilities. Dad had made this discovery. Then my aunt had seen something. Then what had happened with my sister. This phenomenon had occurred, and I didn't realize until years later it had continued to occur throughout her life. I didn't know. I thought it was just one event. But now my sister grows up, and she marries a man. He is a nuclear physicist working at General Atomic. He doesn't know anything about her past. And General Atomic in California, there's a point at which, after they're married for a decade, she feels, I guess, enough courage or whatever. She wants to share with him what's going on with her. And about the same time, he is transferred from General Atomic to Los Alamos in New Mexico. And so she tells him what's going on. He turns around and tells her something, which to this day she's never told me. She told me, I can't tell anybody for fear of what could happen. And you got to know my sister. I mean, she's just simply not. She doesn't seek any publicity. She's never done a radio show. She's never agreed to be interviewed. She's not interested in any of this whatsoever. And lives a very quiet life in a very quiet place where nobody knows where she's at, and that's exactly the way she wants it. And I'm probably the only person, because I believe her and I protect her, I'm probably the only person she's will talk about, including any other member of the family, about this phenomenon. But she told me, and this just last year before I actually spoke at the Roswell 60th anniversary UFO festival. In fact, my lecture was the most well-attended lecture that last year, according to the city, and also according to Guy Malone, who last year organized it for the city. And
Tom, we've only got about a minute and 20 seconds here till break. I just wanted to warn you.
Well, the bottom line is, maybe after the break we can talk about this or move on, but the bottom line was he shared something with her, and maybe 6 months later, for want of a better term, he was disappeared. He's never been seen again. And when my family hired a private investigator to find out what had happened to her family, found out that her husband, who we knew as Joe Trujillo, that was not his name. He was somebody else entirely. And she's trying to find him because she's incapable of working because she's physically disabled, doesn't have an income. Now she doesn't have a husband. Finally, Los Alamos tells her that he was killed at Los Alamos. This took almost 2 years to find out. So then she needs a death certificate so she can draw his Social Security. They would not give her a death certificate. They wouldn't give it to the investigator either, because if they provided a death certificate, then the death could be investigated, and they did not want it to be investigated. Her daughter, who is a federal employee of the Social Security Division, starts shaking the chain up the Social Security Division to try to get her mom Social Security, and finally at some point they simply decreed for her, and as I understand it, this is unprecedented, somebody simply decreed that she could draw his Social Security without the benefit of a death certificate because they didn't want his death investigated.
Okay, I hate to do it, but our mics are going dead here in a few seconds. All right, folks, we'll be back with this amazing story right after this break.
And if I told you everything about the days before you came along, I'd be painting perfect pictures on my canvas of years to be. Around I went looking through my windows out of nothing. My whole world narrowed to the size of a couple of pages in my book.
We are back. Let me remind you, if you joined us late, you didn't hear the announcement at the beginning of the show. We are transitioning. We're migrating the website from one web host to a different web host. And although we thought we had it all done, there are some little glitches. Don't panic. We are getting there, okay? All right. My guest is Tom Horn. And
Tom, we had to cut you off right in the middle of this fascinating story. Now, your sister's husband turns out not to be the person that she thought. In other words, it was not his real name. And then he just disappears. And then Los Alamos tells her 2 years later that he died at Los Alamos. Nobody would give her a death certificate. And the Social Security Administration finally simply decreed that she could draw his Social Security. Is that right?
That's right, and as I understand it, it's unprecedented. By the way, it's all also documented. Everything that I'm telling you can be verified through the sources, through the Social Security Division. And the only reason why, if anybody's ever tried to draw Social Security, they understand to start with, because it's a government bureaucracy, it's very hard to do, even if there isn't anything unusual. And in this case, it would have been impossible, except that, as Providence has it, her daughter is a federal employee with the Social Security Division. And she started rattling chains through the Social Security Division for her mother. And at some point, somebody high enough with enough power simply said she will be allowed to draw this Social Security, and did that. And she, by the way, and that's until this day now. This has been going on for about 6-7 years. Until this day, she is still drawing Social Security for a man named Joe Trujillo, whom she married, and they had filed tax returns and everything else, Social Security, all that numbers for all those years, and it was only an investigator who went to Los Alamos to try to find out something about this death that was told, you know, that discovered that wasn't really his name. He was somebody else. He had a security clearance that was very high. Well, she knew that he was, he was working in nuclear and biological warfare for the U.S. government. So she knew he had a certain level of security clearance, made extraordinarily good money. They lived high on the hog, for want of a better term, until the day that he disappeared. And now, and this, Kevin, this goes back once again to this mathematical improbability. And one of these days, I'm going to hire a mathematician to figure this out for me, and probably not too long for now, because my next book, I'm up to about 3,000 pages of research, and I intend to start writing my next book, which I'm hoping to have out next year, and I want to be able to provide some of this material. I should tell people that I documented a bit of this story in my current book, Nephilim Star. And so if they want to read about that, they can. There's also images and pictures and things like that if people want to email me. They can do that at RaidersNewsUpdate@gmail.com if they want some of the images and stuff that I'm talking about in this story, and I'd be happy to provide that to them. But here's what happened, and this is where the mathematical improbability continues to escalate. My niece, her daughter, works for her to get her Social Security. But then, all of a sudden, my niece, her daughter, starts having experiences. Little gray men in the middle of the night coming to her. And these experiences, these visitations to her, are more real, or at least as real, as reality as she knows it. And so she starts having a phenomenon that most people would probably define as alien abduction phenomenon, shortly after helping her mom with this experience. But it doesn't stop there. She goes with her husband to Seattle, Washington. They're going to see the Seattle Seahawks in a big playoff game up there. And they're in the Space Needle with a bunch of friends. Her friends go down the elevator. She goes up. Anyway, they get separated from each other. And she comes outside of the Space Needle with her husband, goes outside standing around in a crowd, a lot of people gathered there trying to find her friends, and all of a sudden a man and a woman in what looked like military garb walk out of the crowd right up to her. They walk straight up to her and they say, "Come with us, you have been chosen." And of course she's not going to go with them because she doesn't know who they are or what it's about. So she asks us about it, and then they explain to her that they are across the road from the Space Needle. Steven Spielberg, this is a few years ago, Steven Spielberg has set up a tent across the road from the Space Needle where they are promoting his new television series, Taken, all about alien abduction. And now, when this happened, I thought, this to me is so extraordinary. I almost feel like I'm living in the Matrix now. How could a person with this background, unknown to any of these people, her mom's background, my father's background, our family's background, how could these people walk out of a crowd and invite her to come over and be part of the promotion for Taken? Well, anyway, so she agrees to go. Goes across the street because they said they're going to give her some movie promo stuff, television promo stuff, and they did, and she gave it to me later. Her husband has to wait outside the tent while she is invited in. She said she goes inside this tent, promo tent, and there's maybe, she said, between 50 and 100 people in there, and it's really weird. They start putting them through a psychological evaluation. They have to fill out all this paperwork. She said it's asking the strangest questions about their cosmology, their concept of God, but not just that. Have you ever felt like you were, you know, in the middle of the night, floated out of your bed, feet first, that kind of thing? And so she answers all the stuff as accurately as she can. And at the end of it, they take her and one other person, they send the other 100 or so people out of the tent, let them go, and then they advise her and this one other person that according to Spielberg's developed criterion, they are most likely, they are the most likely candidates for alien abduction. And they take her and this other person into this back room where they allow them to look at Steven Spielberg's private collection of alien implants. Anyway, there's more to that story. Bottom line is she leaves there. She calls me about it because she can't believe that this happened. I ask her to send me those materials, which she did, and I've still got them. And she goes home. She goes onto the computer. This is maybe a day later. However, she travels back home. She's at her home. She's on her computer. I'm really dumb about technical stuff, by the way, Kevin, so I may not explain this correctly. But on her computer, she has a way of, when she's chatting with her friends, she has a program that snaps a picture of her. And somehow it transmits this picture of her to her friends while she's talking to them, right?
Right.
And she can also see, you know, every few seconds it rolls over or whatever, and there's a picture of her friend that's talking with her. So I don't know how that works, but that's what's happening. So she's sitting there having a conversation with a friend, telling him all about, wow, it's really crazy. I went to, you know, Seattle and Steven Spielberg's people picked me out of a crowd, blah, blah, blah. And her program allows her to also see the image of her that's being transmitted. Well, all of a sudden, an image of her rolls up onto her computer screen down in the right-hand corner, and for the life of her, what looks exactly like one of the reptilian-type beings that have been visiting her in these vivid dreams or nightmares or visitations or whatever they are, is literally on the computer screen. It's on the screen. Her camera just snapped a picture of her, and right behind her is this reptilian being. She completely freaks out. I mean, she jumps up, she's looking around, there's nothing there, but she sends me the image. First of all, she calls me completely terrified. They're here, they're after me, and wants me to pray for her because she's so afraid. And I ask her to send me the image, and she does.
Do you still have that image?
I still have the image, and anybody that wants to see it can. I've had the image analyzed by a police crime lab. It's also been analyzed by two or three photo analysts, including Stan Deo and some others, who are supposed to be experts. And each one of these have concluded that, first of all, the image is not a fake. Whatever the image itself is real. It's not been doctored or changed. But then it comes to interpreting what is the image. And, you know, I've had everything from Stan Deo saying it could be a three-dimensional image or it could be a reflection of light, just creating what appears to be this alien being standing behind her. But I was on Coast to Coast with George Norrie one night talking about this, and he asked me if I'd post the image to Coast, and I did. And that's when I wound up with a cop from a crime lab and some others that analyzed it. I got a lot of really hokey analysis, but I got two or three very excellent analysis.
Well, let me ask you to do this. When we take our next break, if you can you post it to me? Is that available?
I'm not sitting where I can, but after we're done tonight and I hang up, I can find it and email it to you so that, like, after the show goes off, and if I don't know if you do archives or whatever, but people mm-hmm. wouldn't be able to look at it.
Sure.
You can make it available to them right after the show.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That'll work.
Yeah, well, and anyway, the bottom line was the police crime lab said not only did they think it was actually a three-dimensional being standing behind my niece, they even were able to define all the way down to its digits on its hands, its fingers and stuff. And so, but the bottom line is that occurred. Look, my grandmother died in Roswell in 1947. The story, and my parents had to go there and get her and take her back to Oklahoma, where we still own a farm, and bury her in the family grave. There is so much to this story. And the mathematical improbability, the improbability that my father would make this discovery, that then Travis Walton would be abducted in the same area, that then my sister would start having, so many decades ago, what today would be classically defined as alien abduction, but back then wasn't even heard of, this experiencer phenomenon, that then she would marry a man who was a nuclear physicist for the government, who then was restationed at Los Alamos, who was disappeared after telling her that some of the stuff that had happened at Roswell. This is the only thing I can glean between the lines in the story, was that what happened at Roswell was not the official government story.
All right, we have to take a break. We'll be back right after this. More with Tom Horn. Don't go away. Kevin Smith Show audience is anxious to do business with those who support the show. sponsoring the Kevin Smith Show is just plain smart. Get your free media kit emailed to you today by sending an email to adinfo@kevinsmithshow.com. That's A-D-I-N-F-O at kevinsmithshow.com. Get it all. Become a member at kevinsmithshow.com. We're talking with Tom Horn, and we're talking about very, very strange events taking place in his life, the life of his family. And, yeah, Tom, I would say I agree with you that the mathematical improbability is high. The mathematical probability is very low, which, of course, then, once you say that, what you're saying is that there is intelligence and plan behind the events.
That's right. I mean, the bottom line is that I've never felt that I needed to denounce or to retrofit my very conservative upbringing to also be honest enough to face the extraordinary family history I grew up with, and much of my research, such as even my latest book, Nephilim Stargates. It's really a straightforward apologetic for the fact that we live in a mysterious world, and that this world is being sometimes intruded into by an intelligence that some people would refer to as alien. You know, I'll just give you one more illustration, and then I'll move past this. I talked to my sister a long time just recently. And I've come to realize that here is a woman, she's never read a UFO book, she's never read an alien book, it scares her to death. She's never watched, a movie about any of this stuff. And yet the words, the descriptions that she gives me, and this is only just in the last few years that she's been willing enough to talk to me, but her descriptions, after all my years of research, sound in so many cases like some of the recitations of some of the research I found in John Keel and Jacques Vallée's research concerning the sense of dread or total helplessness or whatever that a person can feel whenever these things come. Her very last experience was about 9 months ago now. My mom actually called me, and she said my sister had had a stroke and she was in the hospital. So I called, I talked to her. They didn't know what was going on with her. She'd lost all the feeling in her body from her waist down. Well, but some months later now, I'm on my way to Roswell to give this lecture. And intentionally, I wanted to stop and talk to her because I was going to include part of her story in this lecture. And she tells me privately, actually made me go outside the house. Her and my mom live together now. Go outside the house so she can tell me what she doesn't want my mom to know. And that is that the true story was, early in the morning, she had felt her bed shake one morning. And something took hold of her feet, and she said, instantly I knew they were there. And she said what felt like a moment later, an instant later, she woke up 6 a.m., found herself sideways on the bed with her legs and her feet off the side of the bed. The blankets, get this, were folded neatly and set to one side. Now, once again, the legitimacy of this is it can be verified by the records of the ambulances that came and the neurologists that looked at her. All these medical records exist. She goes to the hospital. She doesn't have any feeling in her legs. The people from the ambulance also think she's had a stroke. That's where my mom got that from. They thought she'd had a stroke. But she goes to the hospital. Cardiologists, neurologists, they all investigate her. No stroke. No explanation for what's going on. She has no feeling in from her waist down, can't walk, and she has to go through weeks and weeks and weeks of rehabilitation in order to get up and walk again. Now, that's one in a long line of events in her life, and now, unfortunately, her daughter's life, and now, as I understand it, her daughter's daughter. So you have a generational thing. And for me, Kevin, as a scholar, you know, I have my formal training, which is mostly what you learn on paper, not so much from life experiences, but it's just your formal education, or what some people might even call indoctrination. But here I was, knowing that my family, that this happened, that my sister is an honest person, these are people that I know, and I've tried to reconcile with my overall background and worldview all of these events, while also remaining completely honest. In other words, I'm not going to say that didn't happen, or I'm not going to lie, and I'm not going to say it doesn't occur, just to try to make somebody somewhere in some community feel better about their theology. And yet I've come to the point, and if anybody who reads my books read them, they'll get this, that I've come to a point where I don't feel like that you have to compromise what you believe, but that above all of that, regardless of your worldview, there is a phenomenon that is occurring, and in popular dialect, we would refer to this as alien experiences. So, bottom line for me was, I concluded, first of all, that beings of possible superintelligence, if you will, but of unknown origin, have been repeatedly reported in the history and mythos of civilizations around the world since the beginning of time, and that they are not only real, but they are similar to the story of my sister and her daughter, and finally now her daughter's daughter. Secondly, that these beings have been interacting with humanity on more than one occasion and involving themselves with the collection of human DNA for purposes that might be unknown, but about which I've speculated at great length. Thirdly, that these beings, I think, are prophesied to return again en masse at the end of the age. And then finally, that these beings are considered by many religious and secular ufologists as being identical to biblical stories of angels and demons. In other words, there are, you know, there's good ones, there's bad ones, just like there's good humans, bad humans. But that many of the secular researchers that have done research in this area are really simply saying the same thing, that religious persons, if you will, down through times have been talking about with regard to the ancient visitation of Siths and angels and demons and succubi and incubi and all of that.
Yeah, well, it's interesting to me. You know, I'm not religious, but I am very, very open-minded, and I read a lot. And I've probably read the Bible more times and in greater depth than most church-attending folk. It's interesting to me. Interesting to me that people who are very religious often have no problem whatsoever with talking about angels, and never stop to think that that is an extraterrestrial. All you have to do is ask yourself, is it from here? Well, if it's not from here, it's extraterrestrial.
Well, and now, Kevin, don't you think that, I have a feeling that everybody at some level is spiritual. Maybe we don't use the term religious.
Well, I think there's a vast gulf between the two.
So, you know, you might say about yourself you're not religious in the sense that you've not adhered to some particular institutionalized creed. But you have to admit that this idea that, I mean, man, that there could be hidden, unseen, unknown intelligence, and that somehow at times, and for reasons that we can't understand, this is reaching through from another world, another dimension, and it is touching us I mean, that is something that intersects with our humanity on so many different levels, including, obviously, spiritually. And sometimes, you know, it almost seems to me as if what's happening now, especially now with everything that's going on with the Vatican and everything else, that this stuff is happening in staged events that are occurring as either we can accept or that we can absorb the ramifications. I mean, think back, you know, 50 years ago, especially to any religious community, the idea of alien contact, I think, as far as I know, 50 years ago, that would have been absurd.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, the first thing they would do is refer you to a psychiatrist somewhere to be evaluated. And they still do sometimes.
Or just say you're demon-possessed.
Oh, that too. That too.
All right, we have to take a break, and when we come back from this break, we'll open the telephone lines for you at 1-800-289-1092.
Kevin Smith at 1-800-289-1092.
And we are back. My guest this evening is Tom Horn.
Tom, let's go straight to the phone line. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Yes, hello. This is Kevin from Iroquois Falls, Ontario.
Hi, you finally made it back to first slot.
Oh, yeah, I did. I know it's all timing.
What's on your mind, Kevin?
Mr. Horn, okay, you study, your books are about the Nephilim and the biblical Nephilim in 2012. As you know, according to writers like Zechariah Sitchin and such, by 2012, we should be coming across the Nephilim's apparent homeworld of Nibiru. What are your thoughts on the Nibiru thing 2012 about Nibiru and the Nephilim or Anunnaki coming back and whatnot? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, the whole thing about Nibiru, I mean, this is, you know, it's, on one hand, it's beyond my pay scale. I read a news story, I think yesterday or day before it, is it Universe Today or something like that? They run a lot of science stories there. And there was a scientist there saying that those who study deep space have found no evidence that there will be a planetoid called Nibiru or anything else that will be coming back into our visual, heavens or whatever by the year 2012. So that's one part of the description. On the other hand, you know, maybe Nibiru is something more of a spiritual manifestation that will occur, something that could occur almost instantly, if you will, and not be anticipated by scientists. If you've read any of my books, you know that we talk about some of the gods of Middle America and the Aztec and Mayan deities, like Quetzalcoatl. And in particular, with this year 2012, you know, we question whether the end of their long calendar and the return of their chief god Quetzalcoatl in 2012 corresponds with other ancient prophecies and the return of extraordinary beings, giants or the gods or whatever of Mayan belief. And when you look at, in my newest book, Nephilim Stargates, there's an extraordinary chapter that I had written by David Flynn. Do you know who he is?
Yeah, I've heard the name before. Yes. Do you also have any stuff in your books about stuff that Steve Quayle has talked about as well?
Well, Steve Quayle is a friend of mine. In fact, I've guest hosted his show for him in the past for weeks at a time. And we do quote some of his research, but there's probably nobody out there right now, at least in our circle, like David Flynn, who has talked about the Aztec and Toltec ruins and Quetzalcoatl and what's going to be going on in the year 2012. Of course, the end of the Mayan calendar, the planetary cycle of the Aztec calendar. There are people, even people who believe in things like the Bible code, that are talking about the year 2012 as being essentially the end of time, the end of the world. But the Maya actually have a different story about that. They talk about past visits of Quetzalcoatl, their feathered serpent. And something that's interesting here is that some researchers say that feathered actually equates to flying technology, while serpent refers to the wormhole, the heavenly wormhole or stargate, and that the return of this god, Quetzalcoatl, through a hole in the sky, there's one version of this where he comes down on a rope ladder, but there's another version of Quetzalcoatl describing him as sailing down on a winged ship, which fits more, of course, with ufology. But in any case, this 2012 serpent rope or winged ship is going to emerge at the center of the Milky Way, and Quetzalcoatl is going to return to mark the end of this current age and the beginning of another age. And there's an extraordinary part of my newest book, this guest chapter by David Flynn, where he ties a lot of this stuff together, including the number 33. That's a number that's important to a lot of different esoteric societies. But he ties all of that to the year 2012, and even to the landing site at Roswell, the UFO crash site at Roswell, New Mexico. He ties all of that to the mountain of Horeb, where the so-called watchers, these powerful angels came down and mutated humanity and gave birth to their own offspring. He ties all of that even to the year 1776. Now, when I say he ties all this together, I mean he ties all of this together in an extraordinary way in sacred geography, linear measurements of the Earth, dates and time. It was so extraordinary that even UFO Magazine just recently ran it as their lead story. Because, for instance, I'll give you just a quick for instance.
Yeah, we've got another call holding, so it needs to be quick.
Oh, well, okay. A quick for instance is he discusses how 33.33 degrees of the Great Circle of the Earth is actually 2,012 nautical miles. And he starts tying all of 33.33 together, Mount Hermon and Phoenicia, the first location of extraterrestrial influence on man, lying precisely at 33.33 degree north, 33.33 degree east, at 2,012 miles from the equator and 2,012 miles from the prime meridian. There's only one other place on Earth where these kind of measurements can be found, and that's the crash site at Roswell, New Mexico. The message being that those who came one time to the Earth may have left a calling card behind to indicate when they're going to return again, and it gives extraordinary precedence to the year 2012. So, without going into a longer description, I would simply say somebody could buy the book Nephilim Stargates. That chapter, chapter 6 of Nephilim Stargates, is one of the most amazing, fantastic discoveries, I think, in recent history.
It is fascinating, no doubt. And I want to come back to that after this call. Caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
This is Brent from Wyoming.
Hi, Brent.
Hey, Kevin. I just want to put a note of caution in there. I'm not discounting what your father found. However, they sound a lot like teepee rings, 20 feet in diameter, anywhere from 4 to 8 feet deep. So if you're...
They sound like what?
Teepee rings.
What is that?
Well, you know where the Indians camped?
Okay.
Teepee rings. They lived in the teepee rings.
The only thing about this is that my dad...
They appeared overnight. Yeah, I know. But what I'm saying is I don't want people to go out there and find teepee rings and say, oh, we have some UFO activity when it wasn't.
Right. My dad was actually, I appreciate that, and certainly I don't want to make something more of it than what it was. Anybody who's researched my family, and this has included even investigators, and one of the leading investigators in the nation investigating my family, found that my dad was an upstanding citizen, and what he did was, I think, beyond reproach. And Dad was a good friend with the Indians. In fact, one of the largest place where they made pottery, I forget what they call it, but it was right there in Arizona, right back out behind Sun City. In fact, I can lead people to this day to a place in the desert right out behind Sun City where for miles, in almost any direction you look, you'll see broken pieces of pottery because this was one of the largest Indian reservations in the U.S., and it was a place where they made pottery. Dad was a very good friend of all these people. The people at Bard Ranch were a very good friend of all these people. And when he made this discovery, the Phoenix Gazette and Dad also talked to the local Indians to ask them if they knew how these holes had been made. I'm not making this up now. If you listen to earlier interviews that I've done on this subject, or even go to YouTube and look at the 2012 discussions I did at Roswell, you hear me make the same comment that my dad and the Phoenix Gazette had talked to the local Indians, and the Indians did not know where these holes had come from. So, I appreciate what you're saying, but even the Indians then at that time did not know how these holes were made or where they had come from.
All right, the telephone number is 1-800-289-1092. It is toll-free in the U.S. and Canada. As we're doing the transition to our new web host, we do not have Skype available tonight. We will again in the future. But you can send a flash message if you're outside of the USA and Canada. Send a flash message to flash@kevinsmithshow.com, and I'll be more than happy to read your comments and questions and ask Tom to comment on them. But again, the toll-free number, 1-800-289-1092. Now, Tom, you were talking about this ratio here, this relationship between 33.33 degrees and 2012. What's important about 33.33? I know that keeps coming up. I see it in a lot of different places. So what's the deal with that?
Well, first of all, the number 33 is really important to esoteric societies. And Dave, when he did this research, I want to make sure I can launch here so that I don't go into just a big long description that takes us out of time. His interest was, if Mount Hermon, according to not just the Bible but some pseudepigrapha and apocryphal and other texts, was the first location of extraterrestrial influence upon mankind. This is the ancient legendary story, and it's told in all these ancient stories. This was the marked location on which intelligence came down and either married to, but I think more appropriately, used the DNA of humans and animals to construct for itself a body into which it could transmit from its location to ours. That's the story, essentially. But so, if they came down on Mount Hermon, might there have been a reason why they chose that location? Might there have been intelligence behind it? And so you go back to that location, and you find that it lies precisely at 33.33 degree north, 33.33 degree east, at 2012 miles from the equator and 2012 miles from the prime meridian. So that seems by itself to be extraordinary, that it's 33.33 degree north, 33.33 degree east, 2012 miles from the equator, 2012 miles from the prime meridian. And for those people that are listening to the show, the location of Mount Hermon in longitude in these measurements is based on the Paris Zero Meridian, the 2.20 degrees east of Greenwich. This is the meridian that was used by the Knights Templar. Now, why this is important is because, first of all, it corresponds to the year and date that the ancient Mayans of Middle America believed that their calendar is going to end, December 21st, 2012. It's also the year they believe that their serpent god and founder of their civilization, Quetzalcoatl, is going to return from heaven, either on a rope ladder or he's going to descend in a winged ship. One of the most important points that David makes about all of this, in my opinion, is when he asks this rhetorical question, in which he says, if the sons of God descended on Mount Hermon with the intention of connecting 33.33 with the number 2012 navigationally, if they intended to do that, then if you look at all these other prophecies that are in their Hebrew texts or everywhere about the fact they also prophesied they were going to return, if they did this the first time, might they also have placed an additional marker on Earth coordinating the year 2012 and 33.33 with their return? Something, in other words, that would draw attention to the possibility of a future return to planet Earth, not just the first coming, but their second coming. And the point David makes is, if his analysis is correct, then it appears that they did, and that is actually the interpretation of the Roswell, New Mexico event, because the impact area at Roswell is 33 degrees north latitude at a distance of 2,012 miles from the equator. And that's just the beginning of the points that he makes in this startling chapter 6 of Nephilim Stargate, partly why this book's become the bestseller, not because of me, but because of David Flynn, who is an amazing discoverer and an amazing cryptoarchaeologist. He's really just now coming into his own. He's been doing this for some years. He actually started the Watchers website when the internet was first invented, and I will tell you that a lot of his research over time has been stolen by names. If I mentioned them, it would create chaos on your radio.
Oh, well, yeah, I mean, that's normal in the field of ufology. Unfortunately, plagiarism and eating their own. All right,
well,
let's...
And now he's written a brand new book, and we are publishing it. It's going to be out July 1 of this year. It's the biggest secret we've ever had in our publishing company. The name of the book is Temple at the Center of Time. and I can't tell you anything about it yet. As soon as I have printed copies, in about 4 weeks from now, I'll send you a review copy if you'd like it.
I'd love it.
It's the most astonishing book, in my opinion, that's been written since he did his research on the year 2012 in Roswell, New Mexico, which was, by the way, published not just by UFO Magazine, but essentially every major esoteric magazine out there that you can find on the shelf at Barnes & Noble reprinted his research, and to this date, nobody has found that they can shoot holes in the research he did, which leaves us only with one conclusion. And that is that this is the most startling coincidence of all time, or that there really is something there about the first coming of these, of what, superhumans, aliens, superintelligence, whatever you want to call them, fallen angels, whatever they are, were, and what they did, was marked in terms of sacred measurements and geography on Earth, and it's only related to one other place on Earth, and that's Roswell, New Mexico. But there's so much more to that. I mean, if you read the sixth chapter of my newest book, he talks about when the latitude of the impact site, 33 degrees north, is multiplied by the universal mathematical constant pi, the result is 104 degrees longitude, and how that the only place on Earth where 33 degrees latitude and 140 degrees longitude exists, except in the middle of the ocean, is at the Roswell crash site in Roswell, New Mexico. And that, what he does, just goes on and on and on to the point that it just staggers your mind that the math, that there's no possible way that what he has discovered here is coincidence.
All right, let's go back to the phone line and to our caller. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
This is Mark from Nashport, Ohio.
Yeah, Mark.
Hi, Tom. Have you ever heard of Lieutenant Colonel Donald Ware?
I'm not sure. Tell me more.
Well, Lieutenant Colonel Ware said something on a talk show the other day that is related, but a little bit off topic in terms of what you have been talking about. According to Donald Ware, in our underground and undersea bases, hybrids are being grown. And in the future, these hybrids will be the future inhabitants of the Earth. Donald also stated that he had heard this from a lawyer of the world government, which on another level is quite interesting, in that we must have an unofficial world government. Anyway, Lieutenant Colonel Ware gave the Latin names of these hybrids and stated that this is actually quite a good thing, and that we are currently in a state of transition as a world. Personally, it sounds kind of strange to me, but I'd be interested to hear your comment on these statements.
I'll tell you what, I would love it, if possible, if you could email me any information you have about that to RaidersNewsUpdate@gmail.com. Could you do that? RaidersNewsUpdate.
Yeah, I think, he already hung up. But he'll hear that. So,
well, if I could get that information, I'd love to know about it, because, you know, when I wrote the Ahriman Gate, the next step for me in the research of this phenomenon is in looking at what the Watchers or the Gods or whatever you want to call them, looking at what they did, because whether you're looking at Egyptian mythology, Zeus comes down, blends himself with a human female, out of that is born Hercules and these great, or whether you're looking at the Genesis 6 of the Bible, where the Watchers came down and they saw the daughters of men and they married themselves to them, out of which are born the mighty men of old, this story is told around the world. There was an event, according to the history and the mythology, the mythos, of cultures everywhere, China, Assyria, Samaria, Hebrew, all of it. They tell this story. Everyone who was sophisticated enough at that time to have some form of, some ability to make records, they tell this story about these gods who came down, but in what they did, they needed to blend human and animal DNA in order to create a body that they could extend themselves into. For instance, there's an ancient book called Jasher. It's not in the Bible, but it is quoted in the Bible, in the book of Joshua and also in 2 Samuel. Jasher 4:18, it says, after the fallen angels went into the daughters of men, then the sons of men taught the mixture of animals of one species with another in order to provoke the Lord, end quote. So that's one example, and if we had several hours, I could give you many, many more of ancient records that tell us this story that seems to be very similar to what the investigators of ufology and alien abduction are saying, that there is an intelligence, and that this intelligence at times pervades itself, invades itself into our reality for the purposes of harvesting what Jacques Vallée called vital energy, matter associated with three-dimensional intelligent life forms, and that this seems to be required as a kind of construct material for achieving incarnation by these beings. Now, the interesting question about all of this, then, to answer the caller's question, what does this have to do, if anything, with what we are seeing now in governments around the world? Australia has already done this. The United Kingdom just last week did this, where they are, on a governmental level, approving the government funding of research, the blending of humans and animals for the purposes of creating chimeras. And on the surface, this is for, you know, creating stem cells so that we can study these stem cells in human-animal chimeras, have to be destroyed at 14 days. We collect their stem cells. We use them for studying various diseases in the hopes that we're going to come up with cures for different diseases. But I can tell you, Kevin, and your listeners, I've been on the who's who, if you will, of the transhumanists, their own radio shows. I've been invited onto their radio shows to debate them. The last one was Dr. James Hughes.
Yeah, he's been on this show.
Well, and you know, he's the director for the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. He's a bioethicist. He's a sociologist. He's a smart guy. He teaches at Trinity College in Hartford. He sits on boards at Yale University. He's buddies with Nick Bostrom and other transhumanists. And Dr. Hughes and I come from completely different worldviews, but we both agree that we are sitting now on the cusp of a radical future in which the integration of enhancement technologies, especially, in my opinion, those related to biotechnology, are poised to take the human race in either dramatically forward or backward, depending on your worldview, but in their worldview, into the next step in human evolution. And much of this, and here's an interesting thing, Nick, Kevin, because I talk a lot about stargates and portals and pathways. Well, when you talk about stargates or portals, there are those that are almost, really what they are is they're futuristic science, wormholes in other words. But they are scientific in the sense how they work, wormhole technology, Star Trek technology. But there's also a metaphysical approach to portals, wormholes. Aleister Crowley performing his Alamantra working, trying to bring an intelligence from one sphere of influence into our level of influence. And then thirdly, there's a mental approach to portals and stargates. The fact that our mind, under some circumstances, some people might call this extrasensory perception, could be made aware of realities that are not necessarily congenial or easy to perceive by persons who might not have those levels of perception. So, but when it comes to Nick Bostrom and the transhumanists and what's happening in biotechnology right now, they actually look forward to the time where we will merge ourselves with animal species. And Nick Bostrom talks a lot about this. He's a professor at Oxford University. And you can go to nickbostrom.com and click on his transhumanist values, which is the thesis he wrote on transhumanism that actually earned him his prestigious seat at Oxford University, in which he talks about blending us with animals for the purposes of opening up new modalities of perception, because we believe, we know, first of all, that animals can perceive things we can't perceive, different levels of the light spectrum we can't perceive, higher levels of hearing at different levels. But we also believe, on a more metaphysical level, that animals can see, for instance, into the spirit world. And there are reasons, biblically, by the way, we know that. Balaam's donkey. Balaam's whipping his donkey, trying to keep it on the road, but Balaam's donkey can see an angel in the middle of the road with his sword drawn, going to take off dumb Balaam's head. Balaam can't see it. There are, you know, I don't know, people listening to this show perhaps have had experiences where, like, their dog might suddenly want to hide under the bed or something, or it's barking at nothing.
Yeah, it's something that you can't see.
You can't see it, but it's reacting to something, and many transhumanists are excited about the fact that by blending ourselves with other species, we might begin opening these other modalities so that now suddenly we can begin seeing into or interacting with modalities we can't see now.
All right, we have to take a break, and we'll be back with Tom Horn. Your telephone calls as well at 1-800-289-1092. Most of the great music you hear right here on Steel Eye Media Network is supplied by the independent artists from GarageBand.com. If you hear a song you like, go over to GarageBand.com, look it up, download it. You can even buy the group's CDs, in many cases, right there at GarageBand.com.
Call Kevin Smith at 1-800-289-1092.
My guest is Tom Horn, and we're talking about some rather amazing stuff. Tom, you're talking about transhumanism, and I tried to make this point with Dr. James Hughes. He didn't seem to want to understand this, but I'm going to make it again. He brought that up about this enhancement technology. will take us to the next level of human evolution. And I pointed out that evolution, as it is understood, believed, praised, prayed to, and practiced by modern science, has nothing to do with technology. It has to do with various modifications that are made based on natural selection. And so some organism, for whatever reason, say a human, grows six fingers, and according to the theory of evolution and natural selection, the six are better than five, and so gradually those with five do not survive as well as those with six and are replaced by those who have six. Well, when you talk about using technology to create enhancement in human abilities, then you're talking about biotechnology. You're not talking about evolution. And if the batteries run down, you get stupid again.
Well, boy, Kevin, I mean, you're so smart, because you really have just hit the nail on the head. And I would tell people that regardless of their worldview, it doesn't matter if you're religious, you're atheist, you're secular, humanist, it doesn't matter. Everything that's happening in biotechnology today ought to be being viewed with attentiveness. And it's not to say that there might not be some benefits to humanity that come out of biotech. I've got an uncle right now that's dying with incurable cancer. And I really believe that there could be a time in the very near future, in the next few years, where those who are studying genetic manipulation will learn how to turn off, essentially, what is happening in genetics to stop cancerous growth. In the same way we're trying to do it right now in this crude way that we do with, you know, using radiation therapy. And for those people who are part of the religious community, I would tell them, look, everything that Jesus ever did, when he healed a person, he stopped what was happening with them genetically. He altered them genetically. He made whatever that disease was stop what it was doing to their body. So there is not a reason. I'm saying this mostly for, you know, my conservative community. There is not a reason to be a neo-Luddite, to be against advances in technology. However, having said all of that, because what Kevin and I are talking about right now is the unnatural alteration of living organisms, and that this could have far-reaching, maybe adverse effects on our environment, and as far as I know, none of these scientists are Jesus, the very slow path into these fields of biotechnology would be the wise path, but the truth is, we're not waiting. We are racing right now as fast as we can forward into genetically modified crops, now funding for transgenic animal-human embryos, because we believe that these new creations are somehow going to open the door to a better evolution of the species. And so we've got moth genes that are being fused with potatoes. We've got pigs that are being given human growth genes. We've got fish that are being implanted with cattle growth genes.
Mice that have been injected with, are implanted with human genes to watch the neural patterns develop in their brains to see if they develop higher intelligence.
And imagine the ethical questions about this when you start humanizing animals. I mean, if a mouse, and Irv Wiseman at Stanford University is the one that's been conducting these experiments you're referring to, the first that he created only had 1% human brains. Now he's actually petitioned to the different people at Stanford University that he needs to get permission from to do this, to create mice that have wholly human brains, 100% human brains. And the ethical question is, if these humanized animals start becoming self-aware, imagine that, an animal that starts questioning, who am I? Why am I here? Is there a God? Now, because you've played God, ethically, it seems like you have the responsibility to become God to these creations, not just to exterminate them. And because right now the guidelines that are being offered to Stanford and others is, if there's any indication that these humanized animals start becoming self-aware, that's the key phrase, self-aware, that they are to be exterminated. But really, I mean, is that how God is supposed to behave with its creation? That if it starts questioning who it is, you just kill it? I don't think so. This is the extraordinary questions that are being raised, Kevin. But what people out there listening to the show right now need to understand is we're not talking about theory here. This is happening right now. It's happening all around the world in hundreds of laboratories. And by the way, for people who think that this is not happening in the United States, this is happening all over the United States. In certain states like California, where the governor has pushed for the funding of stem cell science, it's happening in California. Other states where the government has not pushed for it and even fought against new legislation that might allow for the funding of this technology, it doesn't mean it's not occurring. It just means it's being privately funded. And it isn't just humans. It's also plants and other kinds of living organisms. And what people need to know is that when it comes to, for instance, the food that you're eating, the FDA allows the producers of the product, for instance, Monsanto. I have an insider in Monsanto, and they allow them to do their own testing, and then they accept the reports of those corporations at face value that the biotech creations are safe. So we're talking about government policy owned by corporations. My gosh, run for your life. In the end, Kevin, I mean, I hope that we don't have to learn what I've called, in the past, I've called this the Brundle Fly lesson. You recall that old movie, The Fly, there was this scientist called Seth Brundle,
mm-hmm.
and he's conducting teleportation experiments. And what he doesn't know is there's a fly in one of the teleporters, and he's in the other one. And during his teleportation experiment, he accidentally has his DNA combined with a common house fly. And soon after that, he starts becoming this superhuman, this transhumanist. I hope he didn't get mad at me, but Dr. James Hughes' dream come true. I mean, he's got lightning quick agility, perceptions into the animal kingdom, heightened senses, superhuman power, the sexual proclivities of an African lion. But then something happens, and he starts transforming into a hideous monster. And the irony is, Jeff Goldblum, who played Brundle in the remake of that film, he also stars as this Weasley-looking character, Ian Malcolm, in Jurassic Park, who subscribes to the chaos theory. And as he's being chased down the road by a giant man-eating Tyrannosaurus Rex in that Jeep, if you remember that scene, he wants to know who in the world thought this was a good idea to bring back these extinct species. And it makes the point you made a moment ago, that if evolution had decided to selectively remove these organisms from the earth millions of years ago, maybe there was a reason, and that in any case, unnaturally combining these organisms is, it, regardless of your worldview, it's not something creation, if you're a creationist, allowed for, and it's not something evolution, if you're an evolutionist, allowed for, and what will the impact on our current environment be? It's unpredictable, and genetically modified crops are already showing us that the crossing of species barriers in unnatural ways are going to do things to the environment that we are not prepared for. And so then you ask yourself, when one of these experiments that they're doing right now that are human and animal, get out of the box somehow, and one of these part pig humans or part goat humans somehow escapes and gets out in the environment and breeds with some natural goat or pig or whatever, and these things begin multiplying. There could be prion contamination, there could be crossover of diseases from animals to humans that we are not prepared for, and that nothing in either creation or evolution has prepared us for. It could literally become a biological nightmare, a Pandora's box.
We have a break coming up, and let me just say this. When you have a whole bunch of these enhanced transhumans on the planet, they will view themselves as superior to humans, just as we would view ourselves as superior to that mouse that has a human brain. And then the question comes, they're under orders now. Once that mouse begins to act in ways that indicate that it's self-aware, they're to exterminate it. If they're willing to do that, would they be willing, as enhanced transhumans, to exterminate all the rest of us who are just natural humans?
So it seems to me that transhumanism is a great leap toward the extermination of the human race. We'll be back right after this.
get it all. Become a member at kevinsmithshow.com.
Call the Kevin Smith Show at 1-800-289-1092.
We're talking with Tom Horn, and we're talking about some really rather esoteric stuff, and yet it's real. It's, as he said, you think it's theory, it's not. It's happening in laboratories all over this planet. Now, Tom, one of the things that comes to mind when I think of this transhumanist stuff, you know, when you go back and look at the data that we have about the sons of God who went into the daughters of men, and the data that we have about their offspring who were giants, men of renown, that's what's in the Bible. But we have, as you said, other accounts that are out there in the pseudepigrapha, in the apocryphal writings, and it says the bottom line on these guys is that they were gigantic. And in most cases, they had voracious appetites of every kind, but just voracious appetites for food, and that they turned to cannibalism, and they were destroying whole populations for food. This is part of the reason, and you get a hint of this in the Genesis account, part of the reason for the Great Flood was to wipe out all living air breathers, and except for one family. Now, the interesting thing it says is that he was chosen because he was perfect in his generations, and it's plural, perfect in his generations, not in his generation, not in his time, but in his generations. His genealogy was perfect. He was apparently purely human. And it says he was a just man and he was a righteous man, but where it says he was perfect, it finishes the sentence. He was perfect in his generations. And this is a book, Genesis, about generations, about genealogy. Now, the correlation in my mind is that you have a race that views itself as superior to the humans, and they begin to destroy the humans. I can foresee the possibility of that with enhanced superhumans, transhumans, looking at the rest of us and saying, you know what, they're eating up the resources of the planet, we really don't need them. What do you think?
Well, Kevin, you would ask this question. I wish we had two more hours now. I mean, this is another thing. For instance, Leon Cass, and who was the president's chairman on his Council on Bioethics, who viewed all of the current science and what it where it portends to take us, and after viewing that science, he wrote a book called Life, Liberty, and the Defense of Dignity, in which he warned that biotechnology combined with transhumanist aspirations would ultimately enshrine eugenics.
Yes.
It would become the new eugenics, exactly what you're talking about, because the goal of transhumanism is the creation of a superior human. And that was, well, first of all, that was the goal of the Watchers, but that was also, more recently, the goal of Hitler, to use the eugenics to create a superior man, the Übermensch. And for people that may feel that what we're talking about here tonight's a stretch of the imagination, I mean, just look at what people like Dr. Francis Crick has written, and anybody who wants to email me, I can email them dozens of quotations by modern scientists who are writing on this issue, and Dr. Francis Crick, where he wrote, and by the way, he's a Nobel Prize laureate. He's the co-discoverer of DNA. He wrote, no newborn infant should be declared human until it has passed certain tests regarding its genetic endowment, and that if it fails those tests, it forfeits the right to live. Now, end quote. So much of this radical ideology entrenching itself, if you will, in the current cultural, social debate. There's so much of this going on that the average person out there would be amazed. First of all, the John Templeton Foundation. They've already provided last year $500,000 to Arizona State University for a lecture series to evaluate the ramifications of doing what you mentioned a moment ago, embarking on what they called, well, let me just quote it to you from their press release. Quote, the large-scale genetic and neurological re-engineering of ourselves, a new chapter in evolution as the result of accelerating developments in the fields of genomic stem cell research, genetic enhancement, germline engineering, neuropharmacology, artificial intelligence, robotic, pattern recognition technologies, and nanotechnology, end quote. They're literally talking about altering us as a species, becoming cyborgs or becoming transhumans, and that this is the next step in human evolution. You might also recall last year, on April 29, Medical News Today announced that Case Law School in Cleveland, they received almost $1 million, $773,000, from the National Institutes of Health, by the way, the NIH, to develop, quote, guidelines for the use of human subjects in what will be the next frontier in medical technology, genetic enhancement, end quote. And anybody who wants to verify this, go and Google this. It's the professor of law and bioethics, Max Malhelm, at the Cleveland School. He's leading a team of law professors there, physicians, bioethicists, and so on, in a two-year project that's aimed at establishing guidelines for, I'm not making this up, this is part of their press release, guidelines for altering the human species through genetic enhancement. That's a quote. And so now, you know, you've got the president's former chairman over here on Council for Bioethics, Leon Cass. In his book, Life, Liberty, and the Defense of Dignity, The Challenges of Bioethics, telling us that human nature now is on the operating table. It's ready for alteration, for eugenics, neurophysic enhancement, for host cell redesign, and he's warning that anybody that cares about preserving our humanity, I mean, the time has come now to pay attention. Because
well,
whether it's...
Look, when they talk about, he's still talking about, you know, the next step in human evolution. The guy that you quoted that is talking about developing guidelines for doing this. Now, when you talk about developing guidelines, you are admitting you have already accepted the idea it's okay. And now you're just going to set some guidelines. Look, we're out of time. We didn't even get a chance to talk about Stargates. This went a different direction than I had thought it would. And I'm not sorry. I'm glad we got into all of this that we got into. And I want you to come back to talk with us about Stargates. But tell the audience how they can get your book.
Well, they can get it anywhere. They can get it at their local bookstore asking for it. They can get it at Amazon.com. They can get it at SurvivorMall.com. They can go to my website, RaidersNewsUpdate.com. I was going to give you my email address there, RaidersNewsUpdate.com. And they can get information there where they can get our last two books really are on this subject. One was a novel, The Ahriman Gate, A-H-R-I-M-A-N, The Ahriman Gate. The most recent book, though, is nonfiction, where we're actually talking about the actual science in transhumanism and what's being proposed and how I view this as being a repeat of what these extraordinary beings of ancient lore did in which they mingled humans and animals. And if you look at what they did...
We're out of time, Tom. I hate to do it, but we're out of time. Folks, Tom Horn. Stay on the line with me, Tom. And ladies and gentlemen,
don't you wish we had another hour? Wow. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do, too, and you can call me whatever you'd like. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.